Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new monthly edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes today. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, Episode 8. This episode, I'm talking with Hardy Jones, who has spent more than 30 years investigating and working to save dolphins. He began unique research on dolphins in the Bahamas in 1978, which has led to 4 internationally broadcast films and many awards. In 1979, he broke the story of the slaughter of dolphins on Iki Island, Japan, which led to international outrage and helped shut down the killing of dolphins in several villages in Japan. Since then, Hardy has worked at Futo and Taiji to stop the last vestiges of slaughter on Japan's main island. Hardy has covered the increasing levels of toxic chemicals in our oceans and the connection to disease in dolphins and human beings. Hardy is a former journalist with CBS News, and he attended Tulane University and studied law at Columbia University under a CBS Foundation fellowship, as well as co-founding the non-profit BlueVoice.org with actor Ted Danson in 2000. Hardy is also the author of The Voice of the Dolphins, which covers his 33 years of work and extraordinary underwater encounters with dolphins, killer whales, and sperm whales. Hardy, thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast. How are you this morning?
Just fine, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you so much. Absolute privilege to have you on. I'm going to start by asking you the question I pretty much ask everyone for the first question, and that is to just give us a little bit of background on how you got into filmmaking. Can you tell us a bit about that, some of that history?
Yeah, I was... From a very young lad, I was interested in news, and for some reason I just wanted to be a CBS News correspondent, and in fact ended up at CBS News after I got out of the Peace Corps, where I served in Peru. So I did work at CBS. It was a wonderful place to work with people like Walter Cronkite and Eric Severide, Richard C. Hodelet, names who were giants during World War II and then for many years after that. But for some reason, I just wanted to be, I guess I got lured out to sea by the dolphins. I started to read about dolphins in the middle 70s and just became so intrigued by the idea that we had this non-human intelligence on our planet that, you know, people are talking about finding extraterrestrial intelligence, but we already had this intelligence in the oceans, and a much better bet for contact and communication than finding something in the, you know, the Crab Nebula or whatever. So I quit the what you might call the hard news business and set out to make a documentary, which was 1978. And I originally thought, well, I'll make a documentary about dolphins in probably in captivity. But I didn't like the idea of captivity, and I thought maybe I should try it in the wild. And pardon me, I hunted around for some place where people were contacting dolphins in the wild, and I found out that really, there was no such place. I met Jacques Cousteau when he was in Seattle, in the in Washington State, and he said, "C'est impossible, monsieur, absolument impossible." He told me, "You cannot contact dolphins in the wild; they will run away." But luckily, I just kept searching and phoning, and I eventually was led to a school of spotted dolphins on the northwest corner of the Little Bahama Banks. And that totally changed my life.
So from that point on, I mean, judging by your work, it looks like you're absolutely 100% hooked on dolphins. What was that transition at that point to filmmaking?
I actually started making films when I was very young I had a Bolex wind-up camera and another camera that I got from a guy who used it in the U.S. Navy in World War II and filmed the Battle of Okinawa with that camera. So I had these two, what we would think today of as antediluvian cameras, but they were 16 millimeter and they did a fine job. So my intent always was to film the dolphins, because at that time there were literally hundreds of thousands of dolphins a year being killed in the tuna fishery, which I think people are generally aware of, but the open seas fisheries for tuna were using these kind of net which trapped dolphins as well as the tuna, and they were killing just literally hundreds of thousands of dolphins. So I said, well, I will go out and make a movie that will bring home the true nature of these dolphins. I'll personalize them. I'll get in with the pods, get people to know how marvelous they are, and this will contribute to stopping the slaughter of so many wonderful animals. And after being discouraged in the idea of doing it in the wild, I met a treasure diver who told me in total confidence where I could find a school of friendly dolphins. And this was this location in the Bahamas. And he's kind of a piratical character. He said to me, I'm going to tell you this because you tell me you're going to save dolphins with it. But if you've lied to me, I'm going to kill you.
Wow.
So, and he looked like just the type who could do it. But I didn't betray him. I put together a partnership, raised money, got a boat, went out into the open sea, to the point that he had indicated. And lo and behold, the dolphins were there, and they were friendly. And I've spent years and years since then filming them. I'm not quite sure how many films I've made of them, but probably four or five. And so that filming was always my intent. It was also the way to pay for it. I paid for these expeditions in two ways. I would get film contracts, and then that was usually not enough to pay for the very expensive proposition of chartering a boat for weeks on end and so forth. So sometimes we would sell the empty berths, the unused berths, to people who would come along on the trip with us. And over the years, I became more successful, better known, and have been able to continue the work for dolphins since then.
So when you first were heading out there to film these dolphins, did you actually have a contract to film to make a documentary when you were first heading out, or was it something you were doing on spec just to gather footage?
Yeah, that's a very important question and a puzzling answer. The first film we did, which ended up being called Dolphin, we did it on spec and were funded by investors' money. It turns out that if you, at least in those days, that if you bring in a finished film, you would get much less for it than if you had enough upfront contract, which doesn't make sense to me, because I would think that a commissioning editor would say, well, okay, we're going to give you $100,000 to go out and make this film. He has no idea that you're going to be successful. It could rain. It could be storms. Your boat could sink. Your camera could be out of focus. I mean, back in those days when you were shooting film, you didn't get to look at it till you got back to land, processed, and screened it. So, I mean, you literally could be have been using a camera that was out of focus completely or flawed in some way or another, as opposed to bringing in a film that was finished and they could say, okay, you got it. There's no risk to us. We either like it or we don't. But we got very little money for that first film. And the amount was, I believe, $25,000. And that came from PBS, Public Broadcasting in the U.S.
But you had to actually raise the funds, like, privately to go out there in the first place. So you were literally putting your neck on the line before you had even filmed anything with investors' money.
Yes, I was putting my neck on the line and their money.
Right. Which, so, you know, it's important, just because I'm... You know, it's one of the questions I get a lot is with new filmmakers trying to break into filmmaking, they, you know, so much these days they want to see the open door that they just have to walk through and they're a filmmaker. And, you know, I think any established filmmaker will tell anyone in that situation that that just doesn't exist, right? There is no open door. You have to make a door, or, you know, if you find a door, you've got to work really hard to get through it. And I think it's just, it's a really good story because of the fact it shows that, you know, you would have had nothing unless you had actually gone, found money and put yourself on the line in terms of owing that money. It had nothing to do with a network or, you know, the network was going to pay you to do this. You actually had to build this career yourself from nothing. And I think that's how so many filmmakers start, and very, very important. And it means that you've got to have so much self, you know, you've got a belief, you've got to believe that you can actually go and do it and have the passion to do that.
Yeah, that's true. And there is no single path. One way, of course, to get started is to have some original, compelling, dramatic subject matter, where you can take it to some agent or distributor or broadcaster and say, I have footage of a great white shark being eaten by a killer whale. And that is going to get somebody's attention. But if you come in with just another story or just sort of a green story about how the earth is going to hell, and we've got to stop it or we're all doomed, nobody's going to pay any attention to you.
Right. And so, sorry, taking you back to where you were, and PBS paid for that first documentary. What happened from there on out? What, with your next film, were you commissioned to make that?
My second film was called Island at the Edge, and it was the film that got me over to Japan when I discovered that they were slaughtering large numbers of dolphins. And I raised that money on private investment. There was a period in the 70s in California where I lived when people were extraordinarily idealistic, and they were up for anything that they thought could, and also a lot of wealthy people, they were up for changing the world. So it was not that difficult to raise the money. The second film I went over, shot the story of the dolphin killing and the complexities behind it, and actually was never able to do very much with that film. It only ended up being half an hour, which is an inconvenient length. However, it did get on CBS News as a news story, and it caused a tsunami of protest against this practice of killing dolphins, and it actually made an enormous change. Many of the villages in Japan that were killing dolphins stopped doing it as a result of the storm of protest that hit Japan due to that footage that I shot.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so that was not financially successful. It didn't get out on the air to a large audience as I had hoped. But the other use of it was as news footage. And it helped move my career along another step. I had more recognition, and we had had quite a thundering success with this investigation. But beyond that, my next films have all been films that my next films until now have all been films which were funded by PBS, Discovery Channel, National Geographic, or other entities of that kind. Today, what we're working on is a film on Peru. So I'm back, you know, to my old Peace Corps stomping grounds. Down in Peru, they kill thousands of dolphins a year for use as shark bait. And what we did is slowly gather funding for this, and we shot it in pieces as the money came in. We sent an undercover guy out on a boat for 25 days, a couple hundred miles off the coast of Peru, and he got the footage of them spearing and butchering dolphins and using it as shark bait. And then he got the footage of the sharks as well, which was ghastly stuff. The cruelty is incredible. So now we're in the position of trying to find a market for that and for that new film. And what we're finding is that the world has changed since I was regularly making films. The last film that I really made as a television film was back in 2006. Done a lot of films for the web and that kind of thing, but now we have this really extraordinary film. It's dramatic. Our guy was in danger all the time. There's some good news around it, so it's not just a total downer of a film. But I'm finding that the world today is incredibly complex with Amazon, Netflix, so many other potential points of release that it's taking a lot of work to figure out how to go.
That's a very interesting point, because I think we're all kind of stuck in this middle place at the moment. The you know, more established filmmakers who are now looking at this change in tide where we have all of these different distribution networks, and then the new filmmakers who are also kind of struggling because they don't know where to go. I mean, it used to be a lot easier with just kind of network TV and the few networks you would go to, and now it does seem there's a plethora of ways to get your work out there and potentially be paid. Obviously, always lots of ways of not being paid, you know, as a filmmaker. And so, how are you at a place now where you see the most viable way of getting that film out, or are you still kind of in the juggling act of working out where it should go?
Well, what I would like to do, the best thing that could happen to us would be to get a distributor or an agent who would represent the film, who knows the business, who knows sequencing is very important in a film. You don't want to go out and, for instance, sell it to Germany alone and then go back to, let's say, Discovery Channel or any number of other outlets and say, oh, okay, well, I can sell you world rights except for Germany. They're going to go, well, Germany's a huge market for us. So you have to sequence your sales so that you get it into the most powerful release that you can first, and then you try to negotiate a contract with Windows, which allow you to sell, let's say, after 3 years, you can sell it to Netflix, but it's very complex. So the good news is there's a lot of ways to go, and the bad news is there's a lot of ways to go.
Absolutely. Well, now, going back a little bit to your days, you know, making actually out there with the camera and filming, it looks to me as most of your work has been investigative journalism, actually out there kind of filming things that others don't want to have filmed. Can you tell me just a little bit about that kind of process? And, you know, it's very different to standard filming where literally you can turn up with a camera most of the time, all the pre-production's in place. And so, you know, the producer's done their groundwork, you turn up and people are expecting you. Obviously, with investigative journalism, you've got to be somewhere, you've got to try and film, you've got to, most of the time, no doubt, do it covertly so that you're not seen. And at the same time, no doubt, you're risking your life. Can you just explain a little bit about that kind of that way of filming?
Well, when we first went to Japan to this place called Iki Island, where they were slaughtering thousands of dolphins, we had a bit of luck. We were told, we could see across a bay that there were dolphins being killed, the bloody water being slashed up into the air and so forth. So we tried to go over, and we were told it's prohibited to go over to the island. There's no way, by the way, that a bunch of Americans can travel around with a film set up in Japan and do it covertly. Some people have asked me, I'm 6'7" tall. Some people have said, well, did you disguise yourself? And I said, as what, a tree?
Right.
I just am not going to pass for Japanese. But what happened was that this old man came up to us and he said, you know, something very interesting is happening out on that island. I can take you there with my boat. He clearly a guy who had not gotten the memo. And so we said, sure. So we got in this boat. We crossed over the harbor onto a point quite far from where they were killing the dolphins. And he landed us. And we then climbed up over a small mountain and came down behind them with our cameras, and we started filming. And they came up to us with spears, and they were literally sticking spears in our face and obviously suggesting that we go elsewhere. But I just kept saying, wakarimasen, wakarimasen, and smiling and, you know, behaving like a buffoon. And it mystified them. They didn't know what to do. Wakarimasen, by the way, means I don't understand. So eventually they kind of turned their back and went back to their bloody business. And we continued to film. Later, we were told that we would have been killed by those guys, except for one fortunate thing, which was that a helicopter from Asahi News was hovering overhead, and the Japanese news network was filming the kill as well.
Oh, wow.
And so the fishermen assumed that we had come out of that helicopter and that therefore we were heavy hitters. They didn't know we were just a gaggle of California guys with a few cameras, you know, 100-foot load cameras. They didn't kill us, but That was a, you know, that was dodgy. But then I got off the island, flew to Tokyo with the film footage. I had, and I went to the CBS News Bureau. I had worked at CBS until a little before that. And they said, yeah, we'll process the film. And they put it on the air. And that was the beginning of the explosive resistance to the dolphin killing in Japan. So I have never properly gone undercover. But when we have been working in Peru, our guy, our Peruvian German cameraman, said he wanted to film shark fishing, and he paid for the gasoline for the boat to go out. And so he was on the boat under false pretenses, which I guess is a sort of undercover. But he did get the footage, and the only way you're going to get this kind of groundbreaking, world-changing footage is to get the stuff, get the bloody stuff where it's happening. And it does involve risk.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those, it's incredible to hear, obviously, how, you know, you were confronted and there was the potential of being killed there. And how did that reinforce what you were doing? Did it make you feel, you know, more driven to highlight these things? I mean, obviously you were driven anyway, but you've gone on to found bluevoice.org, which is a nonprofit all about saving the dolphin and marine mammals. Tell us a little bit about that and kind of how these experiences reinforce, you know, what you're doing now.
Well, what happened from our effort to go to Japan, which was really, you know, a very small effort, a very small group of people, small amount of money, really didn't know what we were doing until we got there. But once we got there, we got the footage, we got it on CBS News, satellited around the world. And suddenly you're left with a realization that, my Lord, me and a couple of buddies with our cameras can have this kind of impact. So there's no excuse in the future to say, I can't do anything about this thing. Whatever it is that you see and that you care about and that's in danger, you can't say, well, gee, I don't know what to do. I can't do anything about it, because, you know, once you have that experience of, you know, just blasting your way across the international airwaves, and you know you can do it again. So there's an obligation, and that obligation dovetailed with the fact that while I was working on these tragic stories in Japan, I was working on the marvelous story of the spotted dolphins out in the Bahamas. And that even raised my level of urgency, because I would see any dolphin killed at Iki, Japan, as being the equal to the dolphin that I knew in the Bahamas.
Now, that the spotted dolphin in the Bahamas, that's a story that I think I watched a bit of a video clip about, with the hammerhead shark. Is that right? Where the dolphins come in and chase away the hammerhead?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, can you explain a little bit about that clip?
Oh, sure. I had been out filming for 5 or 6 hours that day, and it got to be late in the afternoon. Everybody else had gotten back aboard the dinghy, and I was in the water just enjoying that late afternoon magic light, warm water, like kind of lying on my back, taking a short break before joining the group. And I looked down and I saw this large creature coming towards me. with a bunch of dolphins kind of swimming around here and there. And then I noticed that the shark had a, I'm sorry, I noticed that this creature had a horizontal, sorry, the creature I was focused on had a vertical fin instead of a horizontal fin. And I said, that ain't no dolphin I've ever seen. And then I could see the flat front part, mandible of this shark. A hammerhead shark, and lone hammerhead sharks in the Atlantic are potentially dangerous creatures. There are places where you can swim with hundreds of hammerheads, smaller ones, luinis, and they're really not dangerous, but the hammerhead in the Atlantic can be dangerous. And it was coming right towards me. And so I said, what do I do now? And I said, well, of course, get the camera up as something that will be between me and the shark, and I can bump it if it comes straight at me. But I also turned it on, and the shark continues towards me across the sand. And all of a sudden, just with a whoosh over my shoulder, my left shoulder, come two dolphins, and from the right side come two more dolphins, and they dive on the hammerhead, screaming their dolphin high-pitched whistles and click trains. And what I think they were doing is blasting the very sensitive lateral line on the hammerhead, because once they turned up the volume and they dove in like a squadron, they joined into four and they dove on the hammerhead in formation. And clearly it totally upset the shark. It started twisting and writhing and then just disappeared into the blue. Obviously, anybody who looks at that footage will say that the dolphins saved me from the onrushing shark.
And the incredible thing about diving or swimming with dolphins, I've had the pleasure of filming on the sardine run, and a bait ball of sardines with dolphins, common dolphin, coming through and feeding. And there is something amazingly special about being with those creatures, because they do make you feel like you're part of their pod. I mean, it literally, you feel like you're communicating with them, when really you're just kind of, you're in their space, and they accept you. So how has your kind of your love for them, if you like, you know, over the years expanded with that kind of, I mean, I can see from my limited experience, I've dove with dolphins twice now, and I can see how captivating it is to want to get back in the water constantly with them. Is that kind of what drew you to them in the first place?
Well, what I tried to do it's described in my book, The Voice of the Dolphins, which actually contains a lot of stories that I was never able to film and are very illustrative of the kind of things you're talking about. But I think the overall message that I was trying to get to people was that these dolphins they're not people dressed up in dolphin suits. They are a parallel creature who is every bit as sensitive and intelligent and aware and loving, social as we human beings are. So I do believe that when you're dealing with a dolphin, you're dealing with a creature who is pretty much like yourself. And I am not a new ager. I went to law school. I worked in the news business. And if anything's going to make you skeptical in life, it's law school and working in the news business.
Right.
So I consider myself a very objective observer. And I can tell you from my experience that they are very, very much like us. The book ends with the story and the movie I did for PBS, which was called The Dolphin Defender, ends with a reunion that I had with one particular dolphin in the Bahamas, whom we called Chopper. I first met Chopper in 1979 when he was a little pup, and he had a distinctive mark on his dorsal fin that enabled us to very easily identify him over the years. When I went to PBS to pitch the story that I wanted them to fund, I said, yes, I'm going to find this dolphin that I first knew in 1979. I'm going to find this dolphin, and we're going to film the reunion.
Wow.
And they said, oh, that's fabulous. I think that's what sold the film to them. And then, of course, you walk out of the office and say, oh, my Lord, what did I just promise?
Right.
But the fact was, and again, this is truth, on the last day of our shoot, we'd been out for 3 or 4 weeks looking for him and filming other aspects, obviously filming all the time, these other aspects of the dolphins' lives. But on that last day, he showed up. And I saw him from the bow of the boat, got in the water, swam over to him, and started making a bunch of clicks and whistles of my own. And he turned towards me and gave a sonar blast, checking me out. And I think he said, good Lord, it's that tall one again. And he came screaming over to me and swam circles round and round and below me. And then we just settled into this long eye-to-eye swim together, where we were both on the same tack. And it was so clear that he recognized me that, great thing about film, you can tell these stories in print and people might say, is he exaggerating? But in this case, once you've nailed it on film, you've got the evidence.
Oh, what an incredible story. Now, that that filming you were doing there was for, or the first time you met Clipper, that was with The Dolphin Defender, correct? The movie you made. That, I believe, was with Rick O'Barry and the moving the two trapped dolphins that were captured for the kind of the entertainment industry. Is that right?
Well, the first film that I did was called Dolphin Back, and that was released in 79. The Dolphin Defender was released in 2006, which contained some elements of this Nicaragua dolphin rescue that Rick O'Barry so ably carried out. But that had been shot a few years before, couple or 3 years before. So the Dolphin Defender is an amalgamation of the high points of my life in the world of dolphins. And that was a great success story. Rick is a really extraordinarily energized and dedicated guy. We went down to Nicaragua. There were these two dolphins in what was essentially a cesspool of water. And Rick organized a pump, got the water changed. He organized the Nicaraguan Navy, and he got fish for them and electrolytes, and he propped the dolphins up for a couple of days, and then we got into this helicopter and helicoptered them to a couple of weeks of rehab on this corn island in the Caribbean, and then they were released. It was just a high point of my life to watch those dolphins go in the water. And then we waited about 30 seconds and we said, oh, well, they're gone. But after about 30 seconds, they came back towards our boat and just did this flying leap in perfect tandem. And then they disappeared forever.
Oh, that's beautiful. Now, that is available, I believe, on Amazon to rent or buy. Is that right? I think the Dolphin Defender is on there.
Yeah, actually, a lot of my work is on Amazon.
Okay.
The Dolphin Defender is certainly there, but there are others of my films that are there as well.
And that's wonderful. What I'll do on our website podcast page is I'll put a resource link so people can find those and go straight to them and check them out. Now, some of the videos on the bluevoice.org website are, you know, really, really hard to watch, obviously, because of their graphic nature of the slaughter of dolphins. How do you find that? Filming that, you know, when you're actually there, and obviously, you know, your primary goal is to get it on camera so that you can get this out to the world. You know, what's it like? How do you cope with that experience? Because it's hard enough sitting in front of your computer or TV and watching that stuff to actually be there and feel that kind of energy around the place. You know, how does that make you feel?
Well, the first thing is your adrenaline kicks in. So adrenaline gives you a feeling of more power than maybe you actually have. So you feel a little bit invincible. Like the Japanese guy comes up with the spear and sticks it in your face, and you go push the spear away and say, "I don't understand," and smile at him. And you know, if you didn't have the adrenaline, you wouldn't be able to do that. But the other thing is that, yes, you're looking at scenes which are unbelievably horrifying. I mean, dolphins just being stabbed to death in front of your eyes. And you could say, well, oh, this is terrible, or cry or shout or get emotional. But that's not what happens, really. What you realize very quickly is there's no room for my emotions here. This is just way too big for me to get into my personal feelings now. What I do now is I take all of the evidence that I possibly can gather, put together the most powerful film and still images and storyline, and that's my responsibility at this moment. There's no room for anything else. And then, okay, you do your job. You go back to your ryokan or your hotel or wherever you pitched your tent. And then at 2 o'clock in the morning, you wake up and go, holy hell, what did I just see?
Does that kind of haunt you with the amount of that you've seen? Do you have reoccurring kind of nightmares about that kind of stuff?
Yeah, actually, I do. It's not like my life is plagued with nightmares, but in my case, because I end up editing a lot of this material and writing it, and I'm revisiting it constantly. I see the horror again and again and again, and I can tell you, it doesn't get any easier over time. It's as vivid as the day I was there. But you do have the satisfaction of knowing that you are getting this material out to the world, and in the case of a PBS film, it's likely to be seen by 20 million people around the world.
When watching an investigative journalism piece, a documentary, you know, it's hugely inspiring. It kind of leaves you wanting to do something, wanting to help. And I know as a filmmaker, there's been many times that I've looked at stories and felt that, you know, they're possible stories for me to tackle in that way. What would you say to filmmakers who are looking to get into investigative journalism in terms of kind of exposing, you know, a situation through film? Is it something that they really need to think about very hard and fast before getting involved in? What kind of advice do you have for them?
Well, you certainly, if you're going to go to Japan or you're going to go to Peru and try and get in the way of fishermen who are going to kill dolphins and maybe, I mean, the guy we had out on that boat for 25 days, 200 miles offshore, if they had discovered what he was really up to, they could just very easily have used him as shark bait. And then they get back to land and they say, oh, gee, it was terrible. The guy fell overboard. We did everything we could to get him, to rescue him. But tragically, we couldn't. He's a goner. So you need to be aware that these things can involve threats to your life and think that through. Often, though, well, yeah, you do get a sense of a place. In Japan, you are much safer than you would be, let's say, if you went to Venezuela or many other countries in the world where they really would kill you if they found you were messing with their whatever, their drug trade or their dolphin killing. They really would kill you. But in Japan, there's a certain restraint that they have, even though it looks like these guys sometimes are going to explode with their rage at us. We kind of trust a certain protocol that protects us. And we always check in with the police. There's no hard and fast rules, but you definitely need to think clearly about it.
And at the end of the day, I think that, you know, most people in those situations, it's the passion that drives them for the particular subject that makes you want to put yourself in that position in the first place.
Yeah, if you don't have any passion, I think you're trying to work without the fuel that sends you forward and keeps you in the field in circumstances of danger and discomfort. You've got to feel it pretty strongly.
So with everything you've seen throughout your filming career, how do you see the future now for marine mammals in general, but certainly the dolphins?
Well, the overriding thing in the world today is the probably climate change. If we can do a lot of great work in individual locations, Peru, Indonesia, Japan, so many different places where so many people are working so hard to achieve change or make things better or prevent them from getting worse. But if we don't solve climate change, it really is very pessimistic outlook. So at this current moment in time, we are focused on preventing the new president of the United States from withdrawing from the climate treaty. And I guess my message would be people really have to get involved. You just can't leave it up to other people to do the work. What's that phrase? If not now, when? If not me, who? That's the kind of thing you've got to, and you've got to realize you can make a difference. There have been these extraordinary demonstrations that because of internet networking have sprung up almost instantaneously at airports and plazas around the United States to protest against some of the really dangerous new policies that are there. So once again, get involved. There are all sorts of ways of getting involved today that are facilitated, especially by the internet. And it's actually very exciting once you go from despair to action, you have just released the valve of energy, high octane fuel that will move you along and put you in touch with other people and ideas and enable you to feel that you can make a change, because you really can as an individual.
I think that's beautifully said there, Hardy. And one of my questions was, how can people help? And I think that has just answered that perfectly. But directly, if we look at BlueVoice.org, your foundation, how can people directly help Blue Voice?
Well, the truthful answer is that the best way to help our work is to send money. We're a very small organization. We do work with organizations, very tightly work with organizations in Switzerland, Germany, Peru, and others around the world. And people often call and they say, well, I want to volunteer for this or that or the other thing. Just volunteers are not something that we can really use. So it takes money to fly people around, to keep them in the field, to edit films, to market the films. And as prosaic as it may sound, that's the best answer I can give. And we have a donation page on our website, bluevoice.org.
And I was just having a look at that actually while you were talking, and just wanted to for you just to tell us a little bit more about Blue Voice while I've got you on here. I see it was founded by yourself and Ted Danson, the actor. And you have a movie that Blue Voice, because not all of your movies are directly through Blue Voice, is that correct? But I think some of them are. Can you just give us a little more clarity on that?
You mean the major films that I've done?
Yeah, that's right. And I see that, I think Blue Voice, you have a film that Michael Douglas narrated. Is that actually via Blue Voice, that made via Blue Voice?
No, that was done in the late 80s, maybe late 80s, early 90s. And that was done for Turner Broadcasting.
Oh, I see.
Back when Ted Turner was running things, a great environmentalist, and that was a very interesting film in that, once again, a fellow named Sam Labuddy had gone undercover on a Costa Rican tuna fishing boat. And he went on and he acted like a clown, like he was the cook. And he acted kind of like a clown, running around videoing everything on the boat for several weeks, just to establish the image of him with a camera all over the place. What happened is they surrounded a school of dolphins off the Pacific coast, and it was a terrible loss of dolphins in the nets. But Sam got the video. The video came out and then became the core of our film that we were doing, which was a lot of it was about happy stuff about dolphins, how wonderful they are, and a lot of the stories I've told you. Then I got in touch with Michael Douglas, and Michael, who I'd gone to school with actually back in the 50s, Michael agreed to narrate it, and he's a very powerful individual. I mean, you see him on the screen and he's an actor, but when you see him in person, there's a radiance to him. And he was really mad about all these dolphins being killed. So he was the host of it and he narrated it. And then we would do inserts of him talking to camera in the film. And then this is pre-internet. So what we did is there was a telephone company, a facility that you could dial, I think it was a 900 number, and each caller would be billed $6, and they would send a telegram to the chairman of Heinz, which owns Starkist, which is one of the major importers of this tuna. And just as it happened, the daughter of the chairman of Heinz saw our film and went and said, Daddy, why are they killing those dolphins? And he said, huh, what? And he looked at it, and 2 weeks later he said, we're not going to buy any more tuna caught on dolphins.
Wow.
So once again, you know, a single guy, Sam Labuddy, coupled with a film that we were putting out, was able to make this change, which has saved the lives of countless dolphins, but hundreds of thousands of dolphins for sure.
And it just goes to show, again, the power of film. You know, I think we all get caught up these days, very much so, about getting eyes on films in terms of, you know, millions of people. I mean, it's always been that way. You know, you want to get millions of views of your piece, but it just goes to show that one person seeing something can make such a drastic change, a vast change. And that's the power that we have with film. Hardy, it's been fantastic speaking with you this morning. Just give your book another plug, The Voice of the Dolphin. Tell us a little more about that. I'm going to put a link to it on the webpage so people can find it on Amazon. Just give us another quick overview of your book.
Yeah, it's actually a collection of my experiences with dolphins from the late 70s up until the mid to about 2005. And a lot of it contains stories that I couldn't film because as filmmakers will know, once you turn your camera on, you've changed the situation. You've got to have the camera to make the movie, but when you turn that camera on, you've changed the situation. So I would go out sometimes without my camera. And one example is when I brought a dog whistle into the water with me. Dog whistles have very high pitch. Dolphins exist in a world of high pitch sound. So I blew it and had no idea what I thought it might evoke casual interest. But what happened is one of the huge male dolphin leaders of the pack came swimming over to me very aggressively. And he swam around me in circles so forcefully that my arms and legs were shaking like a rag doll. And then he bolted off. So I have no idea what happened. But that was one of the stories that's in the book, The Voice of the Dolphins, that I, of course, couldn't film. So the net of that book, I think, is somebody just wrote me the other day and they said, I read your book and I now know what it's like to be a dolphin. Not exactly, but I know that there is a real thinking, feeling creature inside that dolphin. And that was the purpose that I had in writing it.
Oh, that's fantastic. And always great to get such great feedback on a book when you know they're explaining exactly the feeling you had for writing it. Well, again, it's been a pleasure, Hardy. Thank you so much for taking the time out for being on the podcast. I'm going to put links on to bluevoice.org, and just to remind people, there's a donate button on the website, so they can go on there and donate directly to your cause. I'll put links on to some of your films, the ones available to view online, and also to the book. And hopefully we'll get some people getting on there, getting the book and watching your films. Again, been a complete pleasure. Thanks so much, Hardy.
My privilege. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series. You can find out more information on wildlife filmmaking at masterwildlifefilmmaking.com. where you'll find valuable free resources like downloadable reports and video tutorials. Thanks for listening.